If you're a pet owner, you want to make sure that your companion stays safe and healthy. But just like a small child, a pet can get into harmful materials and places in the blink of an eye. So the best approach, just like with children, is to pet-proof your home in order to avoid those situations. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time each month to spend with us to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. Dr. Sandy, so good to have you back.
It's nice to be here. You know, the reason why this topic came up of wanting to look into safety is, as probably most dog owners, as the snow has been melting this winter, I have been outside, you know, picking up all the things that have been unearthed in the snowbanks. And guess what I found? Old, slimy, thawed out, frozen, refrozen rawhide.
Ew.
And we had a dog, actually two dogs from a family come in a while ago at the vet school that got very, very ill from eating this like old rawhide that had been sitting outside for a while. Remember, that's an animal part. And so anything that's on it is going to be able to multiply when it's laying out there wet and in the, you know, the slightly warm weather we've been having. So keeping, you know, keeping an eye out for things like that, I think, is really important. So, of course, I immediately picked it up and made sure that they are not around for our dogs to chew on.
And you didn't even know.
I didn't even know they were out there, you know, and it was like, oh, look at that, you know, in a snowbank, something's sticking out. So, yeah.
Well, and I'm guessing, too, looking around the yard as things start thawing, I mean, there could be other things. There could be small animals that maybe even died.
You know, bird feeders are another thing. I'm looking at my bird feeders and all the seed and things that's accumulating, and that is an area that we can run into a lot of troubles with, not only with birds getting infected with bacterial infections, but it's also a source of infection for our pets, too. Mm-hmm. So keeping underneath bird feeder areas cleaned up, you know, that compost pile that may have been covered with snow, if you don't have it, you know, already, you know, secured in a compost bin, could potentially be a source of problems, too. As again, as things are warming up, we get molds and so on. And those are very attractive things for pets. It'd be quite toxic.
And also, I'm guessing that there might be a difference. You're in the situation that you have a new pet, but he's an older pet.
Right.
But he's the one you said that must have been taking his rawhide.
Yeah, because I've never had a dog that would, you know, let a rawhide bone out of their sight, let alone bury it in the backyard. But he has never had them before. And so this is kind of a new thing for him. And he's like, oh, dead animal, bury it. Yeah. So, yeah. So that's we're calling him Bruce now, but his real name's Gentleman Jim Dandy. So, yeah.
A very attractive English bulldog.
Right.
Sandy knows I love bulldogs, and so she was sharing pictures. But so Bruce is an older new dog, but I'm guessing also if you're used to having adult pets, just like adult people, that if suddenly you have a new kitten or puppy, you might not even be tuned into the things that they might find really tempting.
Yeah. And cats and dogs are very different. Cats are not vertically challenged, and they can get up on things. I can remember back, this was several years ago when I lived in a different community, I had a cat, and I got her in the summer, not even thinking, started the wood stove. And she jumped up on it and burned all 4 feet. And so something as simple as that, which is like, you know, you would think, you know, how stupid could I have been to let her be in the room while that stove was going? But I didn't even think about it, you know. So anytime you introduce a new pet, it's, you got to watch. They all have different chewing capabilities, counter surfing abilities, you name it. And making sure that your house is definitely pet proofed is important.
We had three geriatric cats for quite a while, and then they had all eventually passed away. And then we had a new, not kitten, but, you know, 9 month old kitten who is an Abyssinian and could do a, you know, a jump from a sitting position about 6 feet up. And it was a completely different landscape.
Right. So things that were safe on top of your refrigerator
that you don't even think
about,
like you said. So let's talk about the kitchen, actually. I'm guessing that kitchens can be quite a danger zone.
Well, I can tell you my own personal story. I had back in the past two Basset Hounds that were, you know, the normal, they could sniff out anything. They figured out one time when we were gone how to open the revolving Susan, which had every type of flour, cake mix, pancake mix, even a bag of jalapeno flavored jelly belly jelly beans. Don't ask me why I had them, but anyways, we had them there. And we had a couple of very, very sick dogs because, of course, they went and sampled everything that was in there. And I didn't even think about it, that all it took was a little nudge with their hip and that mm-hmm. could open up. So sometimes we have to, even with pets, install childproof locks to keep them out of certain things. You know, I've had pet owners who have had the hot things on the stove and the dogs jumped up, and we've run into some big issues that way. So watching stovetops, I just think it's a great idea if you've got a dog that's really jumpy to just keep them out of the kitchen totally, whether it's baby gates or other, you know, containment systems. There's things that you can put in, like there's something called scat, which is a can of compressed air with a little noisemaker on it. And when they go past it, it blows air at them and makes a high-pitched squeal, stops them in their tracks, and they don't want to continue on. So it may keep them out of the
kitchen. And it may only take a few times of that
right,
for them to make the association.
Yeah, but even, you know, knives, anything like that, I can't tell you how often. I had a dog that ate a steel wool pad. You can imagine what that was like going through its stomach. But it had, like, bacon fat or something on it they had used to scrub the pan with. And so they didn't even think that it was going to be a problem in the sink, but the Airedale was able to jump up and help themselves to it. So, so really be careful with that. Cleaning supplies, you know, always make sure, and that's not only in the kitchen, but the bathroom as well. Out of reach, not only for children, but for pets as well.
Mm-hmm. Bathrooms and laundry rooms, I'm guessing.
Yeah, right.
So really, there are a lot of the same. I don't think we'd use the air and noisemaker with a small child, but lot of the concepts are really
definitely
the
same. Right.
We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping our pets happy and healthy. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Sandy, are there different, you've specifically talked about some things for cats and dogs, but what about other pets? I've heard that rabbits can do a lot of chewing on electrical cords.
Oh, they sure can. I was visiting my daughter's friend one time when she was in high school, and they have a house rabbit, sweetest little rabbit, and it jumped up next to me, and by the time within matter of a few seconds, they chewed through my pants, a pair of brand new khaki pants, okay? And there was a big hole. And the thing just sat there and chewed on it, and obviously didn't have any trouble from ingesting the fabric, but it just goes to show you how fast things can happen when you're even wearing the clothes that they're chewing on. I had ferrets before, and I remember one time sitting in the living room, and we had left a bathroom door open, and one of the ferrets was running around. All of a sudden, I hear this thump, 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 and here he is going downstairs with a shampoo bottle that he had stolen off the edge of the bathtub. So, you know, that's another very popular pet that can get into so much trouble because they're tiny, tiny holes they can mm-hmm. fit through. And it's amazing when you have one of those in your house, you start realizing just how non-childproof your house really is.
And birds, anything special for birds?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big things with birds is what you use in your kitchen to cook with. Teflon and Teflon fumes are extremely toxic to birds. And so if you are using Teflon-coated pans and you leave it on too hot, it can produce fumes that you may not be able to detect but are lethal for birds. And they can even be in another room and it could cause problems. So I think that that's a, you know, real important thing. I did have one owner that had a bird land in a gravy boat on Thanksgiving. It was a free-flighted bird in the house and flew over to the table and ended up getting a nice hot grease bath and survived and did well. No burns or anything, but took a lot of bathing to get all the grease off of its feathers.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And probably not a lot of happy Thanksgiving diners.
Right.
Well, we have a couple people who have stories to share about pet proofing. So let's go to the phone. And Bill in Kenosha is up first. Hi, Bill. Bill? Maybe we don't have Bill. Let's go to Nick in Algoma. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What's your story?
Well, about a week or two ago, I made myself some supper. And I went outside, and I came back in, and my dog had decided to try to get the dirty pan and use the oven door as a step.
Ooh.
Knocked the oven over and broke the cabinet next to it, and just all kinds of mayhem from that. So I learned that you got to bolt down your oven.
Oh, yes.
And I also, my wife brought home a cat, and this cat seeps out toilet paper or paper toweling.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you put, he opens the cupboards. We had to put child locks on every cupboard throughout the house. And if you leave one shred of that thing out, he is going to shred it and or put it in his water dish.
Oh, well, that's a cat for you. I used to have a cat that if you brought any, like the curling ribbon, that real thin
yes.
ribbon that you find on the helium balloons and so on, if there was even a speck of that in the house, I don't know whether he could smell it, see it, what it was. All he wanted to do was eat it. So we could not have any ribbon at all in our house. So it's, again, you've got to know your pet. And, you know, another common thing that cats like to chew on is plastic bags. And that could really be a problem if they were ingesting any of that because it's not digestible and it could act as a gastrointestinal foreign body.
And also, thanks for that call, Nick. Also, needle and thread.
Oh, yeah. Needles and threads, we see that. In fact, when I was in private practice in Iowa, I had someone call me up. They had a little miniature pincher, which are tiny little tiny dogs. And they said, our dog swallowed a needle and thread. And I said, oh, I better see your dog right away. And they said, well, why? The last time it did it, it passed it. And I was like, whoa, that was one very, very
wow.
lucky dog. And it did pass it the second time. But I think that was a good lesson for the owner to make sure that, you know, sewing supplies, everything is lifted up because you never know what's going to go in the mouth.
Yeah, actually, my husband's cat, who he had before we met, had eaten a needle and thread and had to have it surgically removed.
Yeah.
And
yeah, one thing
not pleasant or cheap for anybody.
Yeah, one thing that just came up recently on one of my little things that I get via email was a penny ingestion. Pennies are, even though they look like copper, they're basically zinc with just a copper coating on the outside. One penny can be enough to be lethal for a dog with zinc toxicity.
Really?
The copper ends up, if there's even a little scratch or anything in it, that zinc is going to dissolve in the stomach acid very, very quickly and can result in lots of problems. And the last dog I had in that ended up having to have surgery and all kinds of medical management, it ate two pennies and a nickel. And one of the pennies was, this was a long time ago, but was minted after 1983, which are almost all the pennies you're going to see now. And those are the zinc wafer copper pennies that we're seeing. So knowing the age of their change that you're dropping on the floor is going to make a
big difference. It's hard to find out.
Right.
We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we are talking about keeping our pets happy and healthy. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today, will be happy to take your calls. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping our pets happy and healthy. And let's go back to the phones and Robin in Monona. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. We have an 11-year-old German wire hair who absolutely adores being everywhere my husband is. And he often is out on the lake in a stand-up paddleboard. And so she likes to sit on the front of the board with him. And he goes pretty far out in some decent-sized water. And we, when we were at Cornucopia this weekend, we noticed they were selling dog life jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there is any reason to, when we're going out either in a boat or on a paddleboard, put one of those on her in case she does get off and gets in a larger body of water?
Yeah, I really think that that's a great idea to have your dog have some type of safety device on them. Even a dog that is noted for being a water dog like a Labrador Retriever or a Golden Retriever or something that loves to be in the water and can swim can get disoriented, can get tired, especially if you're out in the middle of the lake. And if there's some chop out there, that could make things even worse. So just like it should be for people, I think it's a wise idea for dogs as well. Back to my old Basset Hounds again, I used to live in Fond du Lac on a little lake called Lake de Neveu, and we had a small sailboat on the and the pier, and the dogs would go down. Anytime they were down on the pier, I learned again the hard way that they needed to, even if they were just on the pier, wear a life jacket, because my female put her front feet on the boat and rear feet on the dock. A wave came, down she went, and down the dog went, and in I went to rescue her. I found out that just how poorly Basset Hounds can actually swim. So that was just the rule that if you're on the lake side of the house, you need to make sure that you've got your life jacket on. So
well, and I think too, Sandy, you just brought up a really good point that it's not just whether the dog can swim or not. The person, if the person ends up in the water also, mm-hmm. they're going to be worried about the animal, and that's going to be right. an extra stress on the person.
And I've been clawed pretty badly by dogs that are panicking in
sure.
water. They start paddling, and you're in the way, and they can, you know, really cause some injury. So life jackets are a must.
Pet-proofing when you're out on,
right.
on the lake as well. And more on pet-proofing, let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. People think it's cute if a cat likes water. And my son and daughter-in-law had a cat that they had to run water in the sink in the bathroom to give it a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And one time she was shocked. She started downstairs. She had been doing wash. The cat was in the sink where the water was emptying in. You could have a drowned cat from the wash machine.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes the detergents and so on that you're using can be quite caustic, especially to eyes. And if you've got the pet under there or you're washing in hot water, that could, scald the animal as well. I have had... patients that have got stuck in washers and dryers and so on. And I think it's always a good idea to make sure that the doors are kept shut and that before you start it, that you're checking to make sure that no one is in there that doesn't belong in there.
That's a great point, Jackie. So, and as Jackie was saying, you're saying it's okay when I turn it on in the sink,
right.
but how is the cat going to know
right.
that it's different when it's coming
out of
the washing machine? Thanks for that, Jackie. Let's take one more call about pet proofing and we'll go to Bill in Kenosha. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry I hung up on you before.
Oh, that's
I pushed
okay.
the wrong button.
So,
I was trying to take it off speakerphone so I wouldn't,
Yeah.
Sure.
The wrong levels over there.
What's your story?
Well, my daughter last year, her, I guess it's an Australian collie or shepherd type dog,
mm-hmm.
and it's still under a year old. She left the house and forgot to cage it and left something on top of her gas stove that the dog was attracted to. The dog jumped up trying to get it, hit the knob, and fortunately the igniter took off because if you go past it, sometimes it's just gas and mm-hmm. no flame. And I don't know if it's fortunate or not, but it burned her entire kitchen up.
Oh, yeah.
The fire department, somebody had been driving by and just happened to see it and called the fire department. They got the dog out, put the fire out, but she was out of her house for 4.5 months.
I can believe it, yeah. And it's just like stories like that are just, it just really makes you wonder, that we can survive with pets as well as we do. But again, they do make certain devices that are like locking devices for knobs, for
yes.
stoves and things. And I think that's, really, really critical if you've got a nosy dog. Fortunately, I have two dogs that they couldn't care less what's on the counter because they can't get up that far. So it makes life really easy for me. But I'd have to totally change my lifestyle if I had an active dog like this Aussie.
Wow. Well, thanks for that call, Bill. And as you said, a lot of those same devices for keeping kids safe so they can't turn on the stove.
Yep. They work very well for pets as well.
Well, let's change topics a little bit and go to Mark in Rockton. Hi, Mark. Thanks for waiting.
You bet. Thank you. This
sure.
is the Wisconsin idea, Sandy Sawchuk on that Larry Mueller show.
Isn't
well,
it
thank
great?
You.
So, before my question, the last house proofing thing for cats, rubber bands. I found that to be problematic, and they're not allowed in my house anymore because they end up in a cat's belly. So.
Oh, yeah. And we've had cats that just, like the twist ties from, people think that's kind of cute, because you toss them around on the floor, but then you've got a metal foreign body. So you have, those are all things, anything that they can put in their mouth, they can swallow.
Okay, we're being careful. So I have a 9-year-old cat who has always, is very slightly built and always encouraging her to eat more. And she has very hard stools. And lately, they've had a lot of fur in them. She doesn't overly groom herself, but noticeably, if they're cracked in half, you can see the fur. I had a cat like this with hard stools systemically that when she got older, she was losing her bowel tone and needed lactulose to try to soften the stool.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something, while she's still younger, that we could be adding hopefully some kind of good food that would soften her stool? Right now she's on canned food, and I add just a little water so she's well hydrated.
Mm-hmm.
So any other ideas, Dr. Sutton?
Yeah, especially when cats start getting older, if they're normally, they normally pass firm stool, and now you give them a disease that's going to mess with their water balance, like kidney disease or hyperthyroidism, they can really run into troubles with being either obstipated or constipated and require medical care and attention. And it's, you're wise to be looking into, you know, what can you do at this point that she's going to be accepting of. The problem with using things like Lacitone or Cadillacs or any of these things that are out there is they're a malt-flavored petroleum jelly. And for a once-in-a-while type thing, they're not a bad idea. It's just going to help lube everything up. But if you're using them day in and day out to keep a cat comfortable in the litter box, that can be a problem with affecting the absorption of nutrients and so on. And in the long term, it could be a problem. So usually what I like to look at is a couple of other things. I really like using a fiber source, just pumpkin. And for some reason, some cats really like canned pumpkin. Not the stuff with the spices and so on like you'd put in a pie, but just the canned pumpkin. I have people, you know, buy a can. It's inexpensive. You know, give the cat maybe, you know, a teaspoon of it. See if they like it. And you can use it to effect. It is going to add a small amount of calories. I think a student just figured this out last week for me. A teaspoon of pumpkin equals about 10 calories. So it is going to have, you know, some calories in it, but it doesn't sound like your cat has an issue with that. Freeze it in an ice cube tray and just pop out one little cube, and that will last you a couple of days. So that would be one thing to try. The other thing would be an over-the-counter product for humans, and it's called Miralax. It's a dissolvable stool softening agent that has no taste. People take it by mixing it with their orange juice or whatever. But you can dissolve it in, like, just mix it in with their canned cat food. Cats tolerate it. You start again with just a small amount, maybe an eighth to a quarter of a teaspoon, and gradually increase the amount to effect to make sure that, you know, the stools are not too soft and you're going the other direction. So that would be something to consider trying as well. And I've had better luck with that lately than I have pumpkin.
How about something like olive oil? Would that be
that's going to get addition? Yeah, that's going to just get digested and add calories. And so it's not going to reach, unless she's got some type of a pancreatic deficiency where she's not able to break down fats. That's just going to get digested and add extra calories, and it's not going to lube up the other end of her GI tract. So I would not be using that. The big issue with things like mineral oil, I've had people try to give their cat mineral oil, is because of the consistency of it, it's really easy, especially if the cat's debilitated, for them to inhale it. And now you've got mineral oil in the lungs. And it's just a difficult thing for oil for them to swallow. So avoid using that. I did have one of our internists likes using Dulcolax capsules that are used for people as well. And she finds that works really well for her geriatric cats. I've just found that the Miralax seems to be a little bit more well-tolerated because you don't have to pill the cat. Hmm.
Thanks for that call, Mark. And let's go next to Dan in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dan.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As I was preparing to call, I was struck by what a coincidence. I live right near Lake Deneuve, and I walk down Deneuve Lane every day for my walk.
So
it's interesting.
Yeah.
We have a dilemma. We have two older cats, and we're trying to decide when we should put them down. One is my wife's cat, and she's 13, grossly overweight, always has been. She doesn't walk well. She can't groom herself. She has knots on her fur. She likes being brushed, but petting is not out of it. And she's shedding and leaking all over the furniture we have her downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is 17, and she's my sweetheart. She's in good shape, other than the fact that she's completely blind.
Huh.
And she's real. She purrs. When you pick her up, she purrs, and she's really happy. But she just wanders around, bumps into things, and doesn't seem to bother her. But
yeah.
And heartbreaking.
Yeah. And as pets get older, I mean, obviously you've had this long-term bond with both of these cats, and It's hard to watch your pet age, but part of that is, you know, accepting the fact that they're not going to be like they were when they were younger. For the 13-year-old cat that has the weight issue, I think that if, you know, she's matted, get her to a groomer, have her have a lion cut or whatever, where she's going to be more comfortable. She may need more help with being bathed. Many female cats that are overweight can't bathe their back end, and so they end up getting discharged and so on, you know, wherever she happens to be laying down. And a package of baby wipes is going to save you a lot of grief. But, you know, this would be something that, as 13, that's really actually fairly young for a cat. And I think that, you know, working with your veterinarian to come up with a weight loss strategy is probably, you know, going to buy her much more time and a better quality of life, rather than thinking of ending her life because you don't want to put her on a diet. But I think that that would be how I would be approaching this, because those are all things that are, you know, things that you can manage. Your 17-year-old cat that's blind, first of all, I wonder why your cat's blind. Probably one of the leading causes of blindness in geriatric cats is hypertension. Cats become hypertensive for a couple of reasons, mainly kidney disease.
And that's just basically high blood pressure.
High blood pressure that can be managed. Obviously, your vision will not return. She's probably, if that's what caused this. But you can modify your home to be able to make it more suitable for a blind cat, like not moving the furniture, not leaving things out on the floor that she's going to trip over, that's going to startle her. Making sure that you make sounds to alert her to the fact that you're nearby, so that she, again, you're not startling her if you just walk quietly into a room and she doesn't see you. So I think that, again, blindness itself would not be something that I would look at as a life and death decision making thing.
Because it sounds like she has a pretty high quality of life.
She may bump into the odd thing, but hey, it's if she's still purring and active and
eating well,
seeking out attention. I mean, those are all things that we look at. But I think both of these cats sound like they have treatable or manageable mm-hmm. conditions. Then you may be able to have a lot more time with them.
Dan, do you have an idea, or have you been told why she lost her sight?
Well, no. She's been in the basement a lot. She lives in the basement. And I was worried that maybe just leaving the lights off too much just messed up her eyesight or something.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that this would be something to say, let's get her in and have her looked at to see what's going on. Because if it is, you know, just mild visual loss, we may be able to control her blood pressure or whatever, and maybe stop the progression of the disease.
Thanks for that call, Dan. We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine here in Madison. Happy to answer your questions about keeping your pets happy and healthy. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Sandy, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the new Fairness to Pet Owners Act that was introduced in Congress. What is that about?
Oh, well, I'm probably going to get in trouble from my colleagues because I am one of the few veterinarians that is looking at this as all the veterinary community making a big deal of it? But what this basically is it was something that they tried to pass a couple of years ago, and it's currently back in Congress again. And in a nutshell, what it's going to require veterinarians to do is anytime you have a patient in, besides when they're in for an acute condition where you don't have time to go price shopping or anything, we are going to be obligated to provide owners with a prescription so that they can have their choice of getting their pets maintenance drug therapy, whether it be thyroid medication, heartworm preventative, flea and tick preventative, wherever, you know, antibiotics, if it's something that can wait, you know, whatever, through a source wherever they want to get it. And so that's one. The other is that it's going to prohibit veterinarians from either charging for an outside prescription. And when I read that, I was like, I can't believe veterinarians do that.
And what do you mean by an outside prescription?
So, like, I'm going to use a human example. You go to your doctor and you have a respiratory infection, and you don't see your doctor saying, well, here's your antibiotic prescription. You have to get it filled down in our clinic pharmacy downstairs, because that's the only place I'm going to call down there. It'll be waiting for you, and you have to pick it up there. They give you a piece of paper, and they say, hey, you want to go anywhere? Like, you want to go to Walgreens, Walmart, wherever you want to go, here's your prescription. And so for humans, that's just the way it's always been done. But in the veterinary world, I think part of the problem is that many outside pharmacies, especially human pharmacies that are now starting to cater to pets, may not have the knowledge base of dosages and safety and so on that a pharmacist that works with a veterinary pharmacy knows. So there's when I have a client come in, I'm used to writing prescriptions because I work in a big hospital. I have to fill out a piece of paper, a prescription form, and take it to our pharmacy if the owner wishes to have something filled there. But I'm a huge believer in giving owners the option of where they want to go. Just know that even though the ads on TV for some of the online pharmacies say cheaper than your veterinarian, I just priced something out for an owner and we were 50% less than one of the major ones that does an online pharmacy. And she couldn't believe it. She goes, well, I always thought you were going to be more expensive. So this
so
is
it may be true, but don't assume that.
Don't assume it. So I think a number of things. You have the right to get a prescription. Pet owners should know that. Unfortunately, many of them don't. I don't think we need legislation to make veterinarians give them prescriptions. I think pet owners just need to be aware that it has always been their right to ask for an outside mm-hmm. prescription. Be careful about where you get your prescriptions filled. If you're doing it online, I like to have owners look for a little symbol on the startup page called Vet Vips. It's a little gold oval seal that stands for Veterinary Verified Internet Pharmacy. And that tells you that there's veterinarians on staff, that you're going to be getting drugs that are not outdated, that, you know, you can, you know that you're dealing with a quality pharmacy. You can't trust ads. And some of the pharmacies that are human pharmacies are now carrying generic versions of the drugs that we would use in our veterinary practices. And generics, just like in the human world, are not always equal. We just had last year one of the generic heartworm preventatives recalled because of lack of efficacy, even though it's the same active ingredient in one of the big brands. So, you know, things like this happen. So it comes down to trust your veterinarian. But don't be afraid if you do want to say, well, what does it cost at your clinic versus, you know, can I get it elsewhere? I think that any reputable veterinarian is going to be open to letting you do some price shopping.
Great. Thanks so much for that advice, Sandy. As always, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, with us today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine about keeping our pets happy and healthy. And let's go back to the phones and Tammy in Colgate. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I'm actually calling on behalf of a friend who doesn't know I'm calling, so I don't have all of the details. But she's got a lab mix, and he's got the biggest ears I've ever seen on a dog. They're these just huge, floppy ears. And he's always getting ear infections, really stinky ear
mm-hmm.
infections.
Mm-hmm.
And he does not go into the, he's mostly a house dog. He does
yeah.
not go swimming or anything like that. So what can they do to mitigate that? Or, you
yeah.
know, what's going on? Why is this constantly happening? He's always got these stinky ear infection.
Right. Whenever I get a dog in that has an ear infection where we don't have a direct underlying cause, like we don't find a plant seed in the ear or a lot of hair in the ear or something that would make it, you know, predispose the dog to an environment that would make them have an infection, I always think that there's probably some other underlying cause, such as allergies. And people think, well, wouldn't the dog be itchy everywhere? Why are they just getting ear infections? Well, that's dogs. Sometimes it's one ear. Sometimes it's both. Sometimes it's their feet. Sometimes it's feet and ears. But when we have this recurrent over and over and over again, we start thinking about a condition called atopic or allergic dermatitis. And that can be allergies to molds and pollens and house dust mites and all those things. It may be food as well, but remember, it's not the food itself. It's the ingredients in the food, usually the protein source, mm. not grains or anything like that. And so, you know, that would be one of my major thoughts, is that has the veterinarian sat down with this family and said, you know, there may be a problem. Your dog may have a thyroid issue and have greasier ear discharge because it's hypothyroid. And so you have to start exploring some of those things. But the other thing is making sure that it's being treated effectively. Probably the biggest reason for ear infection failure is owners not going back to their veterinarian for a recheck. I can't tell you how often I'll say, I want to see this ear. We need to treat it for the next month. Let's get your dog back in 2 weeks to see how we're doing. I want to be able to see. Sometimes the ear canal is so swollen, I can't get in there to see if the eardrum's ruptured. Do I have a middle ear infection? Is there a polyp or something down in deep that I couldn't see because of all the debris? I think the recheck is really important to make sure that you're on the right track. The other thing that's more in the veterinarian's lap is making sure that you're doing some cytology on the ear, not basing treatment just on, oh, it stinks, here's a broad spectrum ointment, but actually looking to see what type of bacteria you're dealing with, what type of, you know, if you've got yeast in there, what's causing the ear to have this problem so that you can pick and choose the right medication.
So would that be like a swab that they're taking?
Yeah, you take a swab, put on a slide, look under the microscope. And, you know, it does take a little extra work, but that way you're able to know, are we now, especially with recurrent ear infections, we'll often see dogs that have resistant bugs that are not going to respond to the antibiotics that you're applying topically. So I think that that's a really important thing to do. The other thing is owner compliance. Again, I'm putting this back on your friend's lap, but if we have an owner that, you know, when we have a dog that we suspect maybe has allergies, has some problem, this is never going to go away. I mean, you may be able to help if you go through the whole allergy testing route, but this may be a dog that's going to need chronic long-term care where not a day goes by where you're not lifting the ear and having to look and say, hey, do I have something that's starting to brew? What do I need to do? It's kind of like me with my bulldogs looking in every face fold and butt fold and everything to say, what do I need to treat today? Because they can just blow up overnight. So that's the other thing, is making sure that you're cleaning appropriately, that you're using cleaners and so on that are recommended by your veterinarian. I just had someone in the other day that was using oil and vinegar in the vinegar and water in the dog's ears. And I was like, why? That's just putting water in and something that's acidifying, but it's not going to break up the wax. And so it's kind of like making salad dressing. You've got this greasy earwax and you're putting in liquid on top that's an aqueous thing. It's just going to sit on top. Right. It's not going to break it down.
And probably not very comfortable for
right.
the dog either.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully Tammy can encourage her friend to get the dog in.
Yep. Yep. And make sure all those things are being crossed off. The right recheck, the right medication, ear swabs, cleaning appropriately, you know, and go down that whole path.
Thanks for that call. Let's go to Jeanette in La Crosse. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I guess 17 seems to be the magic number today. I also have a 17-year-old pet. It's a Yorkie, and I know you've had one, Sandy, mm-hmm. and you've had a Yorkie in the past. And anyway, she's doing pretty good. She's blind in one eye, and she's pretty much almost deaf, but otherwise she still likes to walk and feel active. But I was wondering, every now and then she'll wake up from sleeping, and I'll pick her up, but her bottom is just sopping wet, and it's not every day, but every once in a while.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there anything you recommend?
Yeah, when we have dogs that have urinary incontinence, we always want to make sure, again, that there isn't a medical reason for her making more urine, such as does she have kidney disease or Cushing's disease, overactive adrenal glands, that may make her drink more water and produce more urine. So getting her in for a good physical to make sure that everything's like on track that way. Once we've ruled out underlying causes that may or may not be able to be addressed, we then start looking at, are there things that we can do. And there's basically kind of two classes of drugs that we use for controlling urinary incontinence in dogs. One is a drug called PPA, or phenylpropanolamine. It helps tighten up the bladder sphincter, but unfortunately also can cause dogs to be hypertensive. Most dogs don't have issues with hypertension when they're young, but when you've got a senior citizen dog, they have more underlying reasons for developing hypertension. We wouldn't want to make that worse. And so if we're using that particular drug, I'd be making sure that I'm monitoring very carefully the dog's blood pressure while they're on it. The other class of drug we use is an estrogen product. And there's a couple of different ones out there. There are human estrogen that we can get through formulating pharmacies. And there's also now a prescription estrogen product that's made just for dogs. It's given by the name called Incurin. And those are both relatively safe drugs, but we do need to monitor blood cell counts because we're using it at a pretty low dose, and it's uncommon, but dogs can develop anemia when they're on the estrogen type drugs. So we like to monitor them. So there isn't like a perfect solution. You may just even want to consider at this point diapers. And so that if she's, you know, deep in sleep and her bladder's full, at least it's going to absorb, you know, what has happened and save you some cleanup. And it does, you know, most of the disposable diapers that are used for infants work very well. If you got like preemie diapers or something for a little Yorkie, that might be something to consider.
Thanks for that call, Jeanette. Let's go next to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Judith.
Hey, Nick.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, two questions, actually. Unfortunately, I got my black lab, which I love. He's my baby. And unfortunately, my daughter talked me into getting a cat. So we got the cat and we got the dog. And my question is, my vet's freaking out big time because the dog, he's, you know, so manly and stuff. When he's eating, the cat will come up and just steal, like, a piece of dog food here or there. And,
yeah,
of course, you know, he's such a vicious dog, he just lets it go. And she's like, oh, my God. She's like, you can't do that because the cat's going to get diseases and the kidneys are going to fail. And
No. I mean, I think it's true that if you were to take a cat and just feed them dog food and they did not have a source of commercially available cat food that's balanced for cats, you are going to run into troubles. Mainly, it's because there's an amino acid that cats are unable to make, but dogs can make it from the basic building blocks in the diet. And it's an amino acid called taurine. When we have cats that are just on dog food, taurine deficient cats, the two parts of the body that really require lots of taurine, one is the heart, and we can see cats going into what's called dilated cardiomyopathy. I'm aging myself here, but back many years ago, I don't know, 15 plus years ago, we did not realize just how much taurine cats needed. And we were seeing many cats that had this dilated cardiomyopathy problem in the late 80s, early 90s. And we, you know, this was something that we suddenly figured out that we better make sure that we've got them on the right levels. And cat food companies really, you know, went through and made sure that the taurine levels are up to snuff on these foods. But because dogs don't need a pre-made form of taurine, they don't have to include that in the food. The other thing that we can see is with long-term taurine deficiency, they can develop blindness. The heart disease can be reversed with replacing the taurine. The retinal changes that occur are permanent. And so that's probably the reason why your veterinarian's upset is that, you know, oh my goodness, if this cat starts to prefer to only eat dog food and not cat food, you're going to end up with a kitty that may be blind or worse, in heart failure.
But it doesn't sound, Sandy, like
no.
a kibble every once in a while.
Not is at all. Not at all. In fact, when my now that I have a dog that we like to nickname Bruce Hoover, because he will snarf up any piece of food left on the floor. When I had my old bulldogs that would just, you know, leave kibble everywhere. One of my cats was like, he was the cleanup crew. He'd grab a kibble or two and run off with it. But not a problem at all.
Well, and I think I've also heard that because of the density of the foods, that a dog that eats a lot of cat food can actually have some digestive problems. Nothing super serious,
cat
I don't
food
think.
Tends to be much higher in protein, higher in fat.
So that's even a little more of a concern than
right.
a cat grabbing
Definitely.
A little dog food. Nick, right. was there another question you had?
Yeah, and one more quick question. We'll be petting the cat, and she's a really lovable cat. I mean, I'm not a cat person, but unfortunately she falls near the hospital.
Of course.
But anyways, I pet her, and she'll kind of like, she won't bite you, but she'll like tease you.
Uh-huh.
And it's just wondering what the idea is behind that. She's not trying to hurt the person because, you know, cats are so strong.
But she's giving you a very clear warning that she's had enough of the kitty massage. And so let her just sit on your lap or move her off your lap and say, okay, we're done, because that may go further. But that's a very clear body language signal that, you know what, I'm done with this. And if you watch very closely, you may actually see that before she turns around and gives you a little, and people like to call them love bites. I hate that term because it isn't, okay? It's, I hate this bite. But they'll start flicking their tail. And so if you start seeing her tail flicking, that's usually, again, a good signal. Okay, I'm getting agitated. Stop what you're you're doing.
And also pay attention, I would say, to where you're petting her,
mm-hmm.
because cats are much more particular, I think, about what parts of the body
right.
you
Some
pet.
Some cats like hate having their rear end scratched.
Or their little fat bags.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Under their belly. You know, a lot of cats like to be touched up around their chin, but not on top of
right.
their head. It's all, you've got to know
so
your
cat. So it may be that you hit that one spot that she
right.
doesn't really like too much, too. Thanks for that call, Nick. We had an email. Let me see here. We had an email that was asking about jade plant. Todd and Delavan said there's a jade plant in the kitchen that occasionally drops leaves. Those are those like little kind of chubby succulent leaves. Our cat is very good at finding them immediately and playing hockey with it on the hardwood floor. If he were to chew on them, which he really doesn't, is there a risk he might get sick?
Well, Judith, I happened to actually pull up the ASPCA's website for me because
there's so many plants.
I can't keep track of everything. And I think it's just good to know that potentially if they were to chew on them, it could cause the cat some trouble. So this may not be a plant that you would want to have your cat have easy access to, even though the plant may be out of the way. If it's dropping leaves, could potentially be a problem. Anytime you're bringing a new plant into your house, make sure that you check to make sure that it is safe to be able to be with the current species of pets that you happen to have. You know, so some of the big things that are coming up as we're approaching Easter season are Easter lilies, highly toxic for cats, and yet there is no warning on there, and people bring them into their home and the cat chews on them and goes into kidney failure and dies. So, you know, that's why it's important that you really know your pets and you know what plants are there.
We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. This weekend next, while Larry is on a WPR trip to Hawaii, and we will be, as soon as Larry starts sending photos from that trip, we will put them up on our Facebook page so we can all enviously follow along on their adventures. Richard in Oregon is up next. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi.
Yeah. What can we do for you?
Well, my brother spends a lot of time in Wisconsin, and his girlfriend had a couple of yellow labs. She lives along the Mauta River in Grafton, and he lives on Lake Michigan. He has a yellow lab also. So I was visiting, and during the season, her two yellow labs during the holidays, actually Thanksgiving and Christmas, they both mysteriously died. I happened to come back at both time periods from the holidays visiting, and I went with her to the veterinarian, and the first vet thought it was an eye infection, and the dog had a limp, and I thought that was kind of unusual.
Can I make a guess as to what they had? Did they have blastomycosis?
Yes, that's what
they were diagnosed with. Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunately a very common fungal infection that we do have here in Wisconsin. And even Larry, the host of the show, had this several years ago. He picked it up in his travels up north. It's a fungus that lives in the soil. It is not transmitted from dog to people. The form that is in the dog is not at risk of causing disease in people. But the location that the dogs picked it up in could potentially be a source of infection for humans. And why dogs, we see more of it in dogs than people, I think it's just because dogs have their nose to the ground. They're inhaling these spores that are down there. And some of the classic ways it presents is either respiratory problems because it's in the lungs, problems with open, draining, non-healing sores on the body. If it gets into the eye, they can have some pretty serious eye infections as well. And, you know, you can see lameness and so on. So there's all kinds of ways it presents. I'm so sorry that they lost them, but, you know, the dogs weren't at risk for the children, but children that live in that area may potentially be at risk.
Thanks for that call, Richard. And that is something that comes up on the on the show. But you get big points as the disease detective.
Well, that's, you know, the Labrador Retriever. That's the one that we see a lot. And that's just because they're hunting dogs. They've got their nose to the ground and they happen to be right where the organisms are.
We had a caller earlier talking about his 17-year-old, I believe, blind cat. And Karen on Facebook says, for blind cats, see the Facebook site for Homer Blind Wonder Cat.
Wonderful.
So we'll have to check that out.
There are all kinds of sites out there that are helpful for pets that have disabilities like this, like for hearing impaired pets or blind pets. I think the big thing is these cats have to stay indoors. Obviously, they don't have any defenses.
Right. And we've been talking a lot about pet proofing houses and yards today. And Laura posted on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, our 35-pound mixed breed dog was just under the weather. We couldn't figure out what was going on until I found evidence in the yard. She had swallowed a lot of those rubber bands and whole bracelets from my daughter's rubber band loom.
So, that's one of those hot toys that people are having their kids play with.
Yeah, and so it says parents be aware.
Yes. Yeah.
And actually, I would think that if you have a child that's doing that, but a younger child, that could be a risk
harmful.
We also had a little follow-up from earlier. Jenny on Facebook says, my pug gets dirty ears. What is a good ear cleaning solution? And she actually says what someone else is using. The internet says a vinegar alcohol water combo to clean ears.
Oh, imagine having an abraded, ulcerated, sore, painful, inflamed ear and throwing alcohol on it. I would not wish that on anybody. Do not use alcohol, okay, in an ear. Make sure that you have the ear checked first. It really depends. I mean, we usually are looking for something that has an acidifying agent in it, a surfactant, something that's going to break down the wax, something like DSS, dioctosodium sulfosuccinate. But you've just, you know, and there's a number of different, like some have other medications and things in them, but your veterinarian knowing what kind of infection you're dealing with and what the patency of the ear canal is like is going to be able to make the right decision for you.
So, is ear cleaning something we need to do for our dogs?
Not just
when there's a problem?
Not necessarily. It really depends on the dog and how much wax they produce and if they have some other underlying problem that needs to be, you know, addressed all the time, like the allergic dog may need to have their ears cleaned more frequently.
Well, we have a lot more to talk with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about. We're first going to take a look at the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I also want to let people know that tomorrow we'll be talking about less companion-y type animals, but tomorrow at 11 we're going to learn about the wonders of the deep seas and the incredible creatures that inhabit them. There's a wonderful new book that's really full of the wonder of the kind of crazy creatures that live and have adapted to various levels of the sea. And then tomorrow at 11:45, a week ago when Scott Craven was on, the topic of the moose die-off in Minnesota came up, and we're going to talk with some moose biologists about what's happening in Minnesota with the moose population. So a lot coming up. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And she spends time with us each and every month to answer pet questions. And we really do appreciate that very much. Sandy, let's go right back to the phone and talk with Peg in Rice Lake. Hi, Peg.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think I have the perfect solution for dog constipation.
Okay.
And I want to know if it would work for cats too.
Uh huh.
I have an elderly dog, and he was moaning and groaning, and the vet never found anything wrong at all. And so I listened to him moan and groan, and finally I thought, I wonder if he's constipated. So I gave him a spoonful of Metamucil in some milk, and I made sure I stirred it up enough in the milk so it quit clotting up. You know, it gets into lumps. And I got it all smooth, and he loved it.
Okay.
Solved the problem. He doesn't moan anymore.
Oh, wonderful. But, you know, the big issue is when we have pets that are unable to defecate, I think it's really important, rather than just trying to try something at home, try to get to the bottom of why they're actually having these issues. Many, especially with cats that have problems with being constipated, need to have fluids given to them. They're often dehydrated. Many of them need the benefit of enemas, which is not a fun thing to do, which is difficult to do at home. Often they are so obstructed that we need to sedate or anesthetize them to be able to evacuate their colon. These can be medical emergencies. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just trying an at-home remedy, I can't be recommending that. But if you've already been to the vet and you've had a diagnosis made and you're just looking for kind of at-home things that you can use, yes, Metamucil is one of those things. It's just not as palatable. Something like Miralax, which has no taste, seems to, for cats, be a little bit easier to get down them.
And so, Sandy, basically you're saying that the symptom might be constipation, but without knowing what's causing it could be actually masking something.
And just recently, a cat that came in that was obstructed, had a urinary tract obstruction, the owner thought was constipated because they were straining in the litter box. And if they did not bring that cat in, it would have died of its urinary tract obstruction. So that is why it really is important to get them in and have them looked at.
Thanks for that call, Peg. And on a similar vein there, Ellen said by email, wouldn't it perhaps be better to use psyllium in a cat's canned food than the Miralax, which would also have additives and other things? Psyllium has been used by people for a long time to help maintain their intestinal tract.
Yeah, and it's just trying to get a cat to eat it. Yeah, you can walk them to it, but you can't make them eat it. Yeah.
So it's fine to try.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And if they won't take the psyllium.
Right.
But psyllium, isn't it like ground
husks? Yeah. And you can get it in like capsule form and so on that they make for pets. And, you know, for some cats, that they're very willing to take things like that, but others can be quite picky.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Ellen in Wausau. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just had a question. A relative of mine has an older cat. I believe he's between 12, maybe 13 years old. Over a year ago, he was diagnosed with autoagglutination.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, she took him in for, it was just a regular checkup, and they found this. However, recently, he started losing some weight, and she took him in, and they put him on prednisone. And what I was wondering, she had moved, so she doesn't have a regular vet where she is.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was just wondering, as far as long-term treatment with something like this, I've never had a cat with this before.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's a kind of anemia. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about what it is, Sandy.
Yeah, well, autoagglutination is where the red blood cells start to develop into clumps, and they start clumping together or agglutinating. And it's because they are usually coated with some type of a antibody that the body's starting to recognize them as foreign, and so they're trying to get rid of them. And it's an autoimmune problem. It often requires lots of medical attention, long-term medical management. It can be life-threatening, lots of rechecks back and forth, and, you know, blood samples to be able to see how the cat is doing, looking for some underlying reason that may be triggering the cat to have a problem like this is also an important thing, too, because, you know, there are other things, infections and so on, that potentially could trigger an autoimmune response like this. So it's unfortunate that she doesn't have a veterinarian close by that she can refer to, because this is going to be something that she's really going to need a lot of hand-holding with. And like I said, can be life-threatening without appropriate treatment.
And actually, this might be a good time to talk about how do we, if we move, say, out of the state or out of the region, what's a good way to find a new vet?
Well, first of all, always ask your veterinarian. They often have colleagues or, people in the area that you may be moving to. I think that's always a good place to start. Number two would be, I tell people one of the things to look for there's an organization called American Animal Hospital Association, or AHA, and practices that have that certification are not necessarily better, but you know that they've been inspected, they have to meet certain levels of quality assurance and so on, not only in anesthesia and medical records and radiographs and so on. So you may have maybe a better luck with a practice like that, but there are many, many practices out there that are not AHA certified that are absolutely phenomenal. Talk to your neighbors, find out where they go, and then start make a visit. Take a, and you either have a well pet visit or, you know, just see if you can have a sit down and talk about their, you know, feelings about things. You may, if you have a pet that maybe has a chronic problem, it may be working in a practice, it maybe has a dermatology specialist or someone that is maybe not a specialist but has a strong interest in dermatology or hematology or whatever it may be helpful for your pet. So it's using your eyes, your nose, you know, how well you like to be communicated with, you know, the location of the hospital, what do they cover, emergencies and so on. Those are all things that you really need to consider. And, you know, I'm just so grateful that I have all my colleagues because I can just go into the vet school and say, here you go. You help me with my pet. Right. And so, you know, I don't think you need a specialty practice at all, but it's definitely helpful to work with somebody that has access to them.
And can a local humane society be a resource for recommendations or
they
not?
Might be able okay. to. I know that I have tried calling humane societies when I've been looking at working into a private practice and say, what is your take on the practice? And sometimes they've been very open with saying, you know, we, you know, don't care for this particular practice. We don't work with them or whatever. But they may not be that helpful as to know what's actually going on sure. in the practice.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ellen. Let's go next to Mary in Ashwaubenon. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to kind of go back to the bird feeders comment of earlier in the show.
Mm-hmm.
I just started feeding birds outside, and I've got, you know, my dogs running around outside. They're always eating the bunny poop and under the bird feeders, and I'm just not sure what the issue is, I guess.
Sure, yeah. And we were talking, what Mary's referring to is Sandy was explaining different pet proofing mm-hmm. strategies indoors and out, and you mentioned bird feeders.
Right. Probably two big things. One would be that spent seed that's down below, that if it's like in my backyard is, you know, got water on it, and there's a big potential for mold, which depending on the type of mold that grows can be toxic to pets if they're ingesting that kind of seed. If they're just walking through it, probably not a big deal. The other issue would be bacterial infections. Besides the birds depositing spent seed, they're also defecating, and that is piling up beneath the bird seed feeders as well. And salmonella is probably one of the big things that we can see that is a fairly normal bacteria in many animals' gut. But if you know your dog's out there ingesting this spent, you know, rotting bird seed, they could potentially be exposed to that as well. So it's just a matter of trying to keep it clean as you can. And I've been going out daily as things melt and have been out shoveling and getting rid of lots of bird seed.
Well, and Dave in Osseo has a related question. So let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. I got a dog that likes to eat chicken poo.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to, he throws up.
Yeah. And, you know, I've known many, many dogs that find that to be a delicacy. And
there are more and more backyard chickens.
Yes. And, you know, chickens, which is, you know, why you always want to make sure if you are cooking chicken meat that you wash your, you know, you're handling everything appropriately, that when you don't want to eat raw eggs because of the risk of salmonella, the same thing can happen with a dog that's eating chicken droppings. Although many dogs are fairly resistant to getting ill with salmonella, we still see some illness. The vet school right now is taking part in a salmonella culture study. We've been doing it for quite some time where we've been people that want to volunteer some of their pet's fecal material get a free culture, and they can, you know, we find out, you know, is your dog shedding this? It's not so much for the pet's health, but for the human that may be handling the waste as well. Just putting that out there, anybody in the Madison area, they're willing to drop off some stool samples, we'd be glad to have it.
Well, there
yeah.
That's not an offer you hear that often, really. Well, Dave, thanks for that call. And Jim on Facebook said, our 4-year-old male pug is unneutered, and I'm wondering if neutering him will reduce his marking around the house and his emerging crankiness. At the moment, we use diapers to contain the problem.
Well, you know, neutering, although you would think that it's going to help this problem, may not necessarily. The dog that I've adopted right now, he's 7.5. He's an intact male. He doesn't do any marking at all. So it may or may not be sex related. We always recommend get them neutered if that's
for other reasons.
For other reasons. But it may also help with reducing marking. And I think the statistics are about 50% of dogs, you'll see a reduction in marking after neutering. The other reasons why dogs mark is because they've got some underlying anxiety disorder. They're anxious in their environment. They have to put up no trespassing signs or, you know, keep off my property. And so they're just putting their urine everywhere to make the house smell like them. And so they're marking their territory. And neutering may not help that. Then you're looking at more behavior modification. It's a very difficult problem to get under control. I also worry about the fact that he's being grumpy. Very unlikely that it's due to the fact that he needs to be neutered. I know we do that. It kind of takes the starch out of their sails, but he may be grumpy for other reasons. And so making sure that he's physically normal would be one thing, that he doesn't have anything painful that's bothering him, and that maybe even working with an applied animal behaviorist to find out if there is something that needs to be addressed from the standpoint of your relationship with your dog that could be causing some trouble.
So a lot of good options there, Jim. Mm-hmm. And we are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And Sandy, you earlier we had someone who had a cat that wasn't that old but was having a lot of issues and was overweight. And you actually shared with me that there's evidence that smaller portions and more frequent meals can help cats slim down.
You got it. You know, and it's kind of when we look at the normal feeding behavior for cats, cats like to eat on average about 13 little meals a day. That's, I mean, and if you know look at their biology, they're out in the field, right, and they're catching mice, and so they're usually active
and
doing that.
They're not stacking the mice up and eating them all in the evening.
And so instead of having like the food being down like just twice a day, here's your food, they eat it all and then they go and sleep. But the fact that they have to get up and move and just have a small bit of food in their tummy, they're going to be more active because they're constantly going to be going back to the food bowl. The problem is if that food bowl is a bottomless pit, they're going to just keep overeating. So it's up to the owner to then be maybe doling out the correct caloric amount of food in multiple little feedings a day. They do make automatic feeders that, especially for single cat households, work really well. Multi-cat households, you may have a cat eat everybody's food all at once. So it comes down to policing cats just like we do dogs.
And so part of it is portion control, so knowing how much your cat needs in the course of a day. But so if you're feeding them the correct amount, is it okay to just leave that whole amount out? Do they self-regulate that way?
It depends. Some cats will eat it all and then start bugging you. And the normal thing for an owner to do is at 3 a.m. when the cat's saying, hey, feed me, to get up and give them more food. So now there's that portion control out the window.
And a perfectly trained owner from the cat's perspective.
Right. So that's the problem, is they may eat it all at once and then they're hungry. So and it's amazing. Some of these cat foods that are out there now, I call it rocket fuel in a bag. I was just had an owner in and it was 512 calories per cup. And we figured out the cat needed about 180 calories a day. And he goes, well, that's not going to be much, like a third of a cup. And I went, yeah, that's not. And, you know, and so even just a nugget or two above that third of the cup line is going to put that cat over and eventually start adding to weight gain. So really have to be careful. And one of the best websites to go to for the caloric content of different foods is one called petobesityprevention.com. Love that site. I'm on it probably 2 or 3 times a day looking up calories and helping owners with coming up with diet plans for their pets.
Our cat gets a third of a cup a day, and she doesn't actually eat it all every day. And,
you're lucky.
Her weight is very stable and Yeah. It's very expensive food because she has inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah.
Luckily, she only eats a third of a cup a day. Let's go back to the phones, and Daniel in Toma is up next. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. I have an Egyptian Mau up here in Toma, and he's had to get stones removed twice in the past 6 months. They're not the easy kind to dissolve. And the doctors talked about some experimental drugs and also possibly turning him into a girl. And I'm just wondering what other options we could have, because it's going to get expensive pretty fast if we have to get stones removed every 6 months.
What kind of stones were they? Were they calcium oxalate stones?
I don't remember exactly. I know they weren't the easy, normal ones.
Okay. There's basically two main forms of stones that cats can get. There's one that's called struvite and one that is called calcium oxalate. The struvite stones, you can use diets to dissolve them. There's some therapeutic diets that are prescription diets that are very low in mineral, high in salt. They make the cat have a lot of dilute urine, and it will eventually dissolve those stones that may be in the bladder. The problem with boy cats, though, is that they may get small enough then that they may plug the urethra, and now you've got a medical emergency with the cat that is unable to urinate. So for female cats, that may be an option. But for male cats, it's something that you have to be really careful and be watchful that they aren't obstructing as you're making those stones smaller. The other type of stone, the calcium oxalate stone, you cannot dissolve those in with diet. You have to surgically remove them, and then usually we're looking at putting them on a specific diet that will help maintain the correct pH, mineral balance, and so on. And most of these diets are, there's one called SO diet, there's a CD multi that Hills makes. So there's several diets like that on the market that you would feed your cat and only feed your cat. The difference between those therapeutic diets and ones that you can get in the grocery store that say like urinary tract health and so on, are that those in the grocery store are just acidifying diets. It may help with preventing some of the recurrence rate of the struvite stones, but it's not going to help cats with calcium oxalate stones. So, you know, don't be grabbing something and thinking this may be helpful for my cat. So I hope that the veterinarian did find out what the stone type was, and so that you can pick the appropriate diet. The surgical option of having what's called a perineal urethrostomy done is basically removing that narrow part of the penis and giving him a wider area that he can urinate through. And it's not really turning him into a girl. He'll still be a boy, but just is missing that part on his back end that tends to get obstructed. So that is kind of a last-ditch effort to be able to help these cats that are recurrently getting obstructed.
And Daniel, did they tell you what kind of stones they were?
Whoop. I don't know if he's there.
All right. Well, lots of good options there. Let's go back to the phones, and Don in Manawa is up next. Hi, Don.
Hi there.
Hi.
Say, I was listening earlier, and I have a dog that has similar symptoms to what you had cat questions on. Started off treating him for dry eye because he was getting a cloudy eye and some mucus. That worked for a while. Now it doesn't seem to be working. He lost a lot of weight while my female was in heat. He wasn't eating. But he does have the very hard stool, dry stool, and he's drinking a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
He has put some of the weight back on, not enough. He still has a good appetite and gets around pretty good, even though he's almost 13.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering if the same advice applies to the dog as the cat.
Definitely. I think that the symptoms that you're describing could be anything from diabetes to kidney disease to Cushing's disease. The dry eye is probably totally unrelated. I have a dog with dry eye where she just does not produce enough tears. She continues to produce the mucus, and so if she gets up in the morning, she may have a little bit of mucoid discharge there, but the liquid part of the tears that is going to help lubricate the eye is just not, she's just not making enough of that. So for treating dogs with dry eye, we have a couple of options. In mild cases, sometimes you can just repeatedly use artificial tears where there's artificial tear lubes and so on that last a long time that you can two or three times a day kind of lubricate the dog's eyes so that they're more comfortable. Some dogs benefit from using drugs that are going to maybe help the tear glands make more tears. They're usually a brand called Cyclosporin. In the human world, it goes by a brand name called Restasis. We use, we don't use Restasis in pets, but we have our own veterinary version of it. And there's another class of drug called Tacrolimus that we will sometimes jump to if they don't respond to Cyclosporin. But it is a lifetime problem, and it takes a lot of owner dedication to keep up with getting it treated. But the drinking war, heart stools, weight loss, that all needs to be investigated separately.
But it's probably not related to
Not related to the dry eye, no.
Thanks for that call, Don. And Sandy, in just a minute or so we have left, one thing we're going to mention is that we often talk about dogs and rabies vaccinations, but is it important to have our cat vaccinated as
Definitely.
Well?
So many people that have indoor cats don't even think about, they're like, well, I don't have to get them vaccinated because they're strictly indoors. But remember, your liability is at risk. If that cat were to bite somebody, you need to be able to show proof of rabies. And I know that people are afraid of vaccinating for rabies because of risk of maybe tumor at the injection site, but there are safe cat vaccine vaccines for rabies out there. One called PureVax that is wonderful, very easy to give. Downside, you have to give it every year, but it doesn't cause any local reaction, and so it's much safer to use for cats.
And if a cat did bite someone and they didn't have
quarantine. Yeah, taken away from you for 10 days.
And so. Not cheap either.
No. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Sandy, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Always so informative and a lot of fun. Coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about the wonders of the deep seas and the incredible creatures that inhabit them and the really incredible evolution that has allowed them to live at various points in the deep sea. And then at 11:45, a week ago, the topic of the moose die-off came up. We'll get more information on that when we visit with Minnesota moose biologists. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.